Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And I got real curious. I kept on receiving photos of my handsome friend, Peter Lance, who has been a professional writer for years and years, in the picket lines in Los Angeles, defending the Writers Guild's positions. And I had a previous guest lined up for today, and I said, you know, I really want to talk to Peter about this because I don't understand what the Writers Guild wants, and it's kind of, I don't know, it affects a many assets and parts of what we consume, and I wanted Peter to explain what this is all about and do this little background. Peter Lance is a 5-time Emmy Award winner, and he's been a writer, gosh, many books, many television shows, many awards. He's been in the Writers Guild for 36 years. He's participated in 3 strikes, and this is his 3rd strike. If you were watching our video today, you'd see behind him the picket lines, placards on strike, Writers Guild of America. I'm interested to know what's going on in Los Angeles, what's the numbers involved, how many writers, what writers do, what's at issue. And Peter's going to tell us all about that because I think it's an important issue. I mean, what we consume as far as what we watch, this is, you know, it threatens a lot of things. Not only that, it threatens the platforms on which we're consuming entertainment, news, etc. So this is kind of a big deal. So anyway, Peter, tell us, you were in Los Angeles for how long, and what were you seeing? Who did you talk to?
Well, I went down with a good friend of mine, Frank Abatamarco, who joined the Writers Guild like in the 60s. I mean, he's a veteran, and he's a very distinguished real estate broker with the Sotheby's in Santa Barbara, and he's an old friend of mine. And the two of us drove down, and we picketed in the morning at CBS Television City, which is near the Writers Guild, and then we went to Netflix in the afternoon, which has an incredible new studio complex in Hollywood. And basically, this is people need to understand, and I hope people understand, because we love these programs, and so many of these what they call binge-worthy series became like just addictive during COVID. I mean, we were shuttered, and you know, series like The Queen's Gambit. I mean, just you just couldn't take your eyes off them, and they're incredibly popular. There's a level of writing today that's on streaming television platforms like Amazon Prime and Netflix and Hulu. And then, of course, there are many new streaming services, Disney Plus, Peacock, HBO Max has been around for a while. But they're all, the quality of writing is so much higher than when I worked my halcyon days in broadcast network television in the 80s and 90s, up to the year 2000. I had about a 20-year career in Hollywood. But the mechanism for producing television is the same. And let me just explain it and then explain why we had to go on a strike, because the studios collectively, the American Association of Television and Film Producers, AMTPT, essentially the bosses collectively, if you will, have just decided to take such a radical approach that we have a contract that comes up every 3 years. And the first strike happened in 1960. It lasted about 140 some days. That was the first strike in the history of the Guild, which goes back to the 1930s. And when writers got a sense, were given a sense of professionalism and formed this union. And there's, of course, the other unions are the Directors Guild of America and the Screen Actors Guild, which is now SAG-AFTRA. They merged with AFTRA, the Radio Television Union. And then, of course, you have IBEW and the technical unions and the Teamsters, and all of these unions employ people and give them decent salaries and health benefits and medical benefits to produce these wonderful shows. And even though feature films are also covered, television has always been the engine that drives entertainment, broadcast and cable entertainment. So let me just give you an idea of how these programs are made, and interrupt me at any time, and then I'll give you an idea of the kind of profits that the studios collectively have been making on streaming. But first, I'll tell you, a year ago, the statistics in July were as follows. The streaming part, in other words, people who get this content, this scripted dramatic or comedic content on like Amazon Prime or Netflix, represented 35% of the viewership. Cable represented about 35%, and it was down about 8% from the year before. And network broadcast television only represented about 20%. So the share of network television, which used to dominate when there were just three networks, even before Fox, and you know, there was appointment television Thursday night on NBC, you know, you just couldn't look away from Friends, et cetera, ER. That era has long since gone, and now streaming represents. But here's the problem. In this latest round of negotiation, our last strike was in 2007 and 2008. It lasted 100 days. My first strike in 1988, a few months after I came to Hollywood and joined the union, that lasted 153 days. But in between the strikes, our three-year contract would be negotiated, and we'd get, you know, bumps over time, improvements, et cetera. In fact, the reason we have a pension and health fund, Elizabeth, is that the writers in 1960, to get that, we didn't even have pension and health benefits in 1960, but all the writers from movies, because prior to television, let's face it, movies dominated what writers did. They actually gave up their residuals, their royalties from all those famous movies in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, up till 1960, they gave that up as a concession to the studios in negotiating a pension and health plan, which I have today. So we stand on the shoulders of the writers that came before us. And the reason collective bargaining is so crucial, without it, we would have nothing. We wouldn't have minimum pay, working conditions would be, and this is true of any industry. So however you may feel about organized labor or not, I can tell you, I worked at ABC. I was a correspondent for ABC News, my first part of my career. And I left before my pension after about 9 years. I started as a producer and left just for many reasons, personal reasons. But my pension never vested because you had to have 10 years to get your... So I never got a pension from ABC. The fact that I have any kind of pension at all is because of the Writers Guild of America. Now,
so let me ask this. You know, I want you to set up a contrast for us, you know, because Richard was saying before the show, well, you know, there's only so much money, but let's take the example of you know, the Queen's Gambit, something like a show that went viral like that. So, yeah. What kind of money are we talking about, and to whom does it go?
Okay, well, like on my website, which is myname.com, Peter Lance, LANCE.com, every day I have a piece at the top on this is now day 18 of the strike, and a report on the strike, and I have a link to the Hollywood Reporter, which has got the best coverage of all, okay, across the board. So people can stay up on it. But in the middle of that piece I have a scorecard that the Hollywood Reporter created, which is about the earnings of the heads of the studios, okay, the people we're negotiating with, their packages. And I'm just going to summarize just a few of them, but you can get all this on my website. The three top executives of Netflix, Reed Hastings, Ted Sarandos, and another lesser known gentleman to the public named Greg Peters, made this year in 2022, the latest year, $130 million. Those three executives from one of these entities, the head, David Zaslav, who's now the head of this new combined Warner Discovery, you know, that now owns CNN. Last year, he got a package of $246 million, which had to do with his appointment to the job and the takeover and the merger. This year, he made $40 million. Bob Bakish of Paramount, $32 million in last year. Bob Chapek, who's already been fired at Disney, he made $24 million. And Bob Iger, who took over, the old chairman, who's back, made $15 million. So that's a combined $40 last year. Jeff Shell, who just got canned by NBC Universal, he got $21 million last year, $10 million this year. And Andy Jassy, the head of Amazon, last year got a compensation of $212 million. Okay? So the point is, they are making staggering profits. The pay packages of the top executives, if they gave up, and the Writers Guild, by the way, and our asks what we're asking for in just this round, we're asking, we have 11,500 members, Elizabeth. We're asking for our members a total package of $496 million a year, and that represent for that would help not only improve our working conditions and the writers that rooms that create these programs, but also that represents less than 1% of the revenue of these studios. That's what we're asking. Yes. And wait, yet they've offered us, when we did the negotiations that led to the strike, where they basically put up their hands and said, it's our way or the highway. They didn't even respond to most of our demands. They locked us out effectively. They offered, I think it's, what is it, $48 million, half of which is just incremental bumps in what already exists as minimum payments. So it's nothing. It's like a joke. And here's the key. They are trying to argue that because the platform, the content comes via streaming, because it's delivered via streaming, that they shouldn't have to abide by the rules in the contract that govern broadcast and cable, which is what the whole contract is based on. Just because it's a different mechanism, I'm just thinking off the top of my head. Let's say you go into a restaurant, you order some food at a restaurant, right? And you pay for it. The food costs the same to prepare for the restaurant, okay? Now, let's say during COVID, you had your food delivered, right? The fact that the food is coming from, like a food delivery service, does that make the food any less costly to produce? Of course not. You pay the money. In fact, you give a little extra to the delivery driver and give him a little extra tip, right? So these guys are actually arguing with a straight face that because streaming is the growing mechanism for the delivery system, because more people subscribe to streaming than watch network TV, that they shouldn't have to throw out all the rules for compensation from the past. That's the essence of why we have to strike, why the directors started negotiations this week. And thankfully, SAG-AFTRA, run by Fran Drescher, okay, the nanny, Fran Drescher, one of the most remarkable labor leaders in America, she announced this week that their negotiations don't even start for 2 weeks, but they're already going to ask to have a strike approval from their membership next week. Like before we struck, they told all the Writers Guild members. And to give you an idea of how important this was to the Writers Guild, this existential negotiation, 98.25% of the guild, including me, voted to strike. So they had the authorization and they went right up to the negotiating hour of midnight on the 1st of May. And then we went to the streets the next day. Put pencils down is what we say. And none of us can work. We could work on a spec script that maybe after the strike we could sell, but we can't do any traditional Hollywood work. So you can imagine how that puts people out of work. And you know, and then now the directors are coming along and SAG. But if we remain united, if the three big unions remain united and you know, basically get these the studios to come up with a decent response, then the strike will end and we'll just go back to the way things were. There's a little bird behind you on the floor in your kitchen. I love it.
Oh, yeah. I see that too. Well, let's go to a quick break and I'll get the bird out of the house. Don't turn that down.
No, let the bird stay. Okay.
We're talking with Peter Lance, and it's super interesting because I've been wondering what's going on with the writer's strike and why is it important? And when we get back, I want to ask a question to Peter, and maybe he can tell us, you know, a show that's a blockbuster, what it makes and who makes it. I think Peter can answer that real salient question because we get an idea of the scale of the problem here.
Right.
So don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm talking with my good friend Peter Lance, and I was curious to find out that Peter's been in Los Angeles for many days now striking, and he's a writer, and he's a member of the Writers Guild, 36 years. This is his third strike, and it's the most poignant, apparently. And the crux of the matter is that the powers that be that make, you know, a annual salary of upwards of 20 mil plus are saying to the writers, well, the package that we support for you guys for broadcast and cable is the package we're going to adhere to, but any streaming is a different method. And so streaming, we're not going to really acknowledge any increase in any benefits for you. And essentially, Peter gave the analogy of the method of delivery in a restaurant. So whether or not the dinner comes to you on a certain plate, or if it comes to you on another plate, it's still the same dinner, still the same cost of preparation. And so this is the crux of the matter. And I asked Peter before the break if he would explain to our listeners, what's the difference between the production? So here's the production. How much does a blockbuster make and who makes it?
Yeah, and by the way, the analogy with food is best compared to being in a restaurant and eating the food, which costs the same to prepare, and ordering it through Grubhub. So now they deliver it through Grubhub because you're home. You give the guy a little extra tip that delivers it. The delivery system is different, but the food still costs the same to prepare. And now let's talk about how television is made, how these incredibly addictive, binge-worthy series are made. They're made identically to the way broadcast television series and cable television series are made, which is that you assemble a writer's room. First of all, a writer, man or woman, has an idea, creates a show. Some of the most famous ones who are doing amazing work are like Shonda Rhimes, who, you know, had owned one whole night at ABC with Grey's Anatomy and Scandal and How to Get Away with Murder. And then she signed a major deal at Netflix, and she's been doing Bridgerton, most recently Queen Charlotte and the Bridgerton analogy. I mean, she's just remarkable. She's just, I mean, I have so much admiration for Shonda Rhimes, but it starts with a blank page with Shonda. Now, in that case, they're adapting books. There's a series of books apparently about Bridgerton, but that's just the framework, the setting. She has to go into a blank page and her writing staff. And by the way, up until this season with the new iteration, Queen Charlotte, that just dropped on Netflix, she is writing that herself. Up until now, she's had other people in her realm. Shondaland is the name of her company that had produced it. But you start with a blank page, all right? And then you assemble a writer's room, and before anything goes on the page, you have to develop the story for the season, the overarching story. Now, when I was working on Wise Guy, we had to deliver 24 episodes a season, our dramatic show. So we had a major writer's room staff, and I was the showrunner. The showrunner is the lead writer, but in television, writers have always been the power figures that have made television work. In feature film, there'll be a script, they'll hire a director. Sometimes it's a writer-director, but often the writer is gone at the start of production, and then, you know, your child is birthed and then raised by somebody else. I mean, that's feature film. But when it came to television, because of the through line, because starting with Hill Street Blues. There used to be just episodic television. You know, Jim Rockford, the Rockford, he wouldn't change. His character would be the same every week, and it was the caper of the week, right? But with Hill Street Blues, Stephen Bochco began having arcs of characters over time. Andy Sipowicz, you know, characters like that later on with Bochco would, you know, develop and have relationships over the course of the season. So it made the writer's presence all the more important. That's the first part. The second part is that after the writer's room assembles and you develop the stories, then you begin to write the scripts. You would make script assignments, and typically there's some given to freelancers, but more typically now, because the seasons are shorter with these binge-worthy series, they're like 6, 8, 10, or 12 episodes. It's much smaller. What you have is a staff. So people go into the writer's room as apprentice writers, you know, or, you know, you're just beginning to learn. You might get a chance to write one episode. Then you become a staff writer. Then you're promoted to story editor. There's a whole structure, like just like the apprentice system in any ancient art in you know, and or industry. And then eventually you learn how to do this. And if you get an idea, if you're on a hot series and you get an idea, you go in and pitch it, and then maybe you get to create a show. So after I was doing, when I was at Stephen Cannell, I started with Michael Mann. The show I worked on was so critically acclaimed, I had an idea to do a police show called Missing Persons, and we pitched it to my old network, ABC, and I was the sole creator, and it ran 19 episodes on the ABC. So, you know, that was, you know, and then I went on to do something else. So that was what a showrunner is. The showrunner is the senior writer and the person who has the entire through line. But writers have to stay with the project throughout. Now let's talk about what happens after the scripts are written, the teleplays,
let me,
right?
Let me interrupt, Peter. Let me interrupt you. Richard's giving us a sign. We've got to go to quick break. Okay. I'm starting to see that this is a multi-cogged wheel.
Okay.
You know, and so starting to grasp and that it all starts with this arc.
With the blank page.
That writers are responsible for. Yeah. Okay. Right. I'm getting that. And then, you know, then we're going to contrast it when we get back from the break. I can hear you say with the kind of money that can be generated from such a show. Right. And Rich, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Elizabeth.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go to quick break. And when we get back from the break, I'm talking with my good friend, Peter Lance. And I was really intrigued. Peter was sending me pictures of himself on strike and picket line in Los Angeles, picketing for the Writers Guild. And I was wondering, what's at stake? And I think Peter brought a really interesting example. Many people had very little social contact during COVID. So we're talking 2-3 years. And I myself, I never watch anything. I'm a reader, but I became addicted to some of the binge-worthy quote-unquote programs just because I wanted to see other faces.
Mm-hmm.
And it was important, you know. It was Schitt's Creek, for example. That, you
right.
know, I mean, I had no like outlet for laughter, this sort of thing. It was yeah. fantastic to rely on something like that, and it's kind of, you know, crash with a bottle of wine beside your bed and just say, okay, here I am. Anyway, it's important. There's some things at stake here, and Peter's explaining how the whole system works. Okay, Richard, let's go to quick break. It's Elizabeth Stewart speaking with my good friend Peter Lance, who's been a writer 36 years involved with the Writers Guild of America. 3 strikes. This is his third, and probably the most, as I say, poignant, because during the break, gosh, it's fascinating. And I want to just jump right into this issue. Well, let's talk about what a show like Schitt's Creek or Yellow Jackets or Queen's Gambit. What a show like that it has the potential to make, because we've contrasted. So with the process, there's a writer's room, there's a head writer, called the showrunner, et cetera. There's many different writers in that writer's room. It starts with a blank page that creates a story arc throughout the series. And then the writers are responsible for each episode along the lines. And that's been the traditional way. And we're going to talk about a little bit about the untraditional way that's being introduced to the writers. But before we do that, let's talk about what a really big blockbuster show can make, Peter.
Hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, if you go to the credits when you're watching, the next time you're watching Yellow Jackets or one of your favorite series, there's one called The Power that's on. I love it. With, you know, Tony Collette and John Leguizamo. There's so many wonderful series. And go to the credits at the end, and you'll see at the very end, the credit, they translate these shows into multiple languages, which means they're selling them worldwide. So it's not just for consumption in America. So these studios are making incredible profits. Earlier in your program, I referred people to my website, peterlance.com, where I have a chart of all the executive compensation salaries. So if the top studio heads are being paid tens and 20s and 30, up some of them $50, $60 million a year as a package, they have to be making tremendous profits, those studios. So, but let me just get to, I want to just finalize where I left off in the writing, the production process, why writers are crucial. After the scripts are finalized and approved by the network, then you have to cast them. You bring in actors, you hire directors who may or may not be on staff and be hyphenate writer directors. And then you shoot the production involving all the other unions, like, you know, the craft unions and the Teamsters, et cetera. And then you have the production, but then post-production begins. And writers have to stay with it throughout. They have to be on the set. Let's say you have a day scheduled to be outside and the weather's wrong, and you have to quickly go indoors because you only have so many days to shoot an episode. The writer has to adapt the script to compensate. And then in post-production, often when I was on Wise Guy, we would shoot like 56 minutes. We had to cut it down to 45, you know, with commercials. And so I would have to figure, how do I take out 3-4 minutes in a scene? And you might have a shot over the shot over the shoulder of one actor, and then you'd have them create new language to make it make sense with what was cut. You see what I mean? So I enjoyed the post-production process as much as I enjoyed the writing process, but it's all part of the writer's crucial role in all of this. And now part of what these studio bosses are demanding, and the reason we've gone to the strike, they want ChatGPT and these artificial intelligence entities to be able to come in and break the original story that would be created by writers in a room and then turned into teleplay. They want to use artificial intelligence for that. I mean, of course, it'll save money. But, I mean, can you imagine what the Schitt's Creek or another show, which depends on the genius of the writers and the language and the cleverness, not just for the dialogue, but for the plot itself to work, especially shows that are mystery, shows like Poker Face, the Natasha Lyonne incredible series, kind of in the format of Columbo, you know, where she solves a crime in every episode. I mean, it's so cleverly done. The story first, then the dialogue, and they're going to use artificial intelligence to come up with a story? You can imagine why we hit the bricks, Elizabeth.
Let me ask you this. At what point in the process, because you were describing the process of how a show or an episode is churned out. So at what point in the process do the producers say that AI should enter?
They want in the early development stages, let's say a writer's room is assembled, like they just finished last season's show, you know, it's production's over, and then X number of months go by. Sometimes if it's really a successful show, they'll green light while it's in production. And then, you know, so right away the writers are still there, but they're trying to get it so that in the process, they instead of regular writer's rooms, they come up with this notion of mini rooms where they have fewer writers and they don't even have to pay. They'll pay them for limited weeks instead of keeping them on for months through the entire production, as I've just described the need for the writers to be involved across the production, because the writer is the author of ultimately in television what people are consuming. The writer is the auteur. Okay. And so what now they're saying, well, instead of we'll make mini writers rooms, and when each new season starts, we'll start with art. We'll have artificial intelligence will generate the stories. And then a couple of senior writers will tinker with those and then tweak those into scripts. Can you imagine how absurd that concept is? And they're saying that with a straight face to our negotiators, that they really want to do that. So, I mean, just think about that. I mean, think about, we understand the dangers of artificial intelligence on so many levels, but to take the clever content of these streaming series, which are distinguished for their writing quality, and to start with AI, I mean, that's why we're on strike and why I hit the bricks in LA and I'm going to go back next week and as long as it takes. We're having a big rally, by the way, on the 26th in downtown LA, huge rally. And I invite anybody within the sound of my voice to come down. It's at Figaro and 12th Street between 4 and 7. And all the members, the 11,000 members are going to be there. There's going to be entertainment, people supporting us, great artists. Some of the many stars of the shows that you love will be there. So come down to LA and let's get a traffic jam going. A respectful one. Let's let people know the reason, why we're doing this.
You know, you're at night when we get back from the break, Peter, we'll go to quick break, but I want to know what the payment is. I mean, it's got to be different. So your salary, for example, what your salary would be on a blockbuster show versus a show that was kind of just getting off the ground. Is there a scale that you're talking about? So where our listeners say, well, that's that compensation sounds very high, very low, et cetera. What are we talking about? What are you?
I honestly don't know. Okay. It's every show is different. And a lot of times with like Shonda Rhimes or a real star, a Ryan Murphy, like both have these huge deals at Netflix. They'll make $150 million, $75 million deal for X number of years. And within that deal, they have to produce a certain amount of content. But they're the stars. Recently, we had a Zoom yesterday with the Guild, and one of the negotiators said that there are 10 star writers in Hollywood that write all their own shows without a writer's room. David Kelly is one of them. These are just like these stellar people. But 90%, and there are only 10 of those for all the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of scripted series. The rest are created with showrunners supervising. They might do the pilot, they might do the first episode of the season and the last episode of the season themselves. But in the meantime, you have writers in the room at different levels writing the scripts, creating the first it's a story that you do, story, and then the teleplay comes along. And that's the purpose of having a writer's room and staying with the series through the whole production and post-production.
Fascinating, fascinating. And when we get back from the break, I want to talk a little bit more about the what the asks are. What are the asks? And so if you could say to the negotiators on your team at the Writers Guild, we want this. Peter says, that it suggests that we should have this. What would Peter Lance suggest that the contract look like when we get back from the break? Love to hear that. Don't turn that down. Hey, Richard.
Yes, Elizabeth.
All right, let's go to quick break. I'm speaking with Peter Lance today. Wonderful, wonderful friend of mine and a member of the Writers Guild of America. He's been in Los Angeles now, protesting on the picket lines with the striking writers. This is his third strike in 36 years of being a guild member and very active in the Hollywood community in general. He lives here in Santa Barbara now, and I'm talking to Peter. He's just on a little quick break. He'll be back in Los Angeles picketing again. Feels very strongly about this for all the writers coming up in Hollywood. Threatened now, we're learning, by the use of AI to create a story of some originality and creativity, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, maybe.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. I'm speaking with Peter Lance. I just got so intrigued this week reading Peter's articles and his little from the front lines details about the Writers Guild strike in Los Angeles. Peter's been 36 years with the Writers Guild of America, went down with another veteran writer, and he's telling us what, you know, he was boots on the ground, and he's telling us what the writers are striking for and why it's important. And what's the package? What's the ask, Peter?
Okay, so on my, I keep mentioning my website, peterlance.com, right at the top is a daily piece that I do on the strike with a link to all the news from the Hollywood Reporter, but along with the executive salaries of the studio heads that are extraordinary, the people that are saying no to us, I have a copy from the Guild of the last offer just before the strike. On one column, you see WGA proposals, and next to it, AMTP offers, the studios. And in multiple blocks, they're just rejected our proposal, refused to make a counter, rejected, refused to make a counter, rejected. Four separate categories. They didn't even make a proposal, okay? And at the bottom, under cost, this is what it says. I'm going to read it. WGA, Writers Guild of America proposals would gain writers, and there are 11,500 writers I'm talking about across the board, $429 million a year would be the gain. And the AMTPT's offer is approximately $86 million a year, half of which is from just a little increase in the minimums. So they're like basically going like this. They're thumbing their noses. They want to break the system now. And part of the reason they're doing that, and I know I'm personifying these corporate titans as the bad guys, but so many of these companies, and they always have, reacted to what Wall Street thinks about them. But the reason in the last year and a half they've made some major slashes in their cost cutting and budget, but while minimally cutting compensation at the top for these billionaires, of which there's a whole chart on my website on the packages. But part of the reason is that Wall Street loves it. The stock prices improve, obviously, if they can demonstrate to Wall Street that they're more efficient. But you can't take an essential element of the production process, which is, what's the New Testament say? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh, right? If you don't start with a Word, you can't build a building, Elizabeth, without a blueprint, right? Can you imagine going in, breaking ground in anywhere, a little house to a skyscraper without a blueprint? The writing, the script is the blueprint for production. And that is created by human beings, not AI. It never will be. You could always use it for research. I mean, it's wonderful to come in. Now, I use the internet now. I'm in the middle of a script, and I want to find out what are the FBI salaries? What were they in 1966 or whatever? You know what I mean? I can do that for research. But I can't go in and ask somebody assigns me to write a script let me have ChatGPT do the first draft. It's insulting, and it's also inefficient. And here's the thing, though, the last part of this, if you don't have the process that we have, the internship, moving up to staff writer, to story editor, up through the food chain to become a showrunner and a creator, you've lost the educational system of how the system works. So it's like they're shooting themselves in the foot. They're trying to destroy the educational process that produces the great art that they profit from.
So what I just learned was something important, is that if they can increase efficiency and cut costs, Wall Street smiles on that.
Yes.
And that's kind of the bottom line of that. And Richard, tell us, Richard, are you there?
He pointed out.
Yes,
single
I'm
finger.
Here.
Okay. Did you say we have to go to break or
one more break? Yes.
Okay. Let's go to quick break so we get a good chunk of the final part of the show in. So I want Peter to summarize what he thinks is going to happen next. I think that's going to be an interesting thing. I know there's going to be a big strike where the public is invited. Peter just invited all of us. It was the 26th, I believe. And so I want to know what Peter thinks is going to happen when we get back from the break. Okay, Richard, let's go to quick break.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Sturr speaking with my good friend Peter Lance about the Writers Guild strike. He's been participating in Los Angeles, and he's going back again. The major rally takes place this coming Friday, the 26th. Peter will be joined by a lot of celebrities and a lot of activities and entertainment. Peter, go ahead.
So we got this notice last night. It's got this typeface from Star Wars that says, "Union, strike back. Next week, we're switching up the usual LA studio picket schedule so writers can turn out for an historic multi-union rally, Union Strike Back Rally and Dance Party on Friday, May 26th from 4 to 7 p.m. downtown at Figueroa and 12th Street near the Staples Center." You know, we're not going to block traffic. There's enough room down there to get. And we had at the last strike, Elizabeth, it's on my website, peterlance.com. I have a picture from the 2007-08 strike. One day, 10,000 people filled Hollywood Boulevard. And we had one of these rallies, Alicia Keys perform. So I'm sure there's going to be some really top talent and people within the sound of your voice and come down. And it's not just the Writers Guild. It's the Teamsters, IATSE, SAG, AFTRA, the Directors Guild. They're all going to be down there and, supporting us. And then the directors are next, and then they screen SAG after. However, this is my prediction for why the strike is going to last a long time. Because of the way the producers reacted to our modest proposals to just give us, a decent living, an incremental, from they've been doing renewals of the every 3 years of the contract incrementally. So, but this time, because of streaming, they thought they could take essentially, again, use the metaphor, instead of paying for the food you'd pay for in a restaurant because it's delivered by one of the delivery services, then we don't have to pay you at all, like because of the delivery system of streaming. So it's so existential, but they're going to wait, I believe, until the directors and the actors go on strike. And if we stay united, then the strike will be over quickly. But if one of the unions buckles, and the directors buckled, if I may say this, last time in 07, 08, near the 100th day, the directors signed, they caved. And then, we all ended up signing. And we signed a deal then that has led us ultimately to where we are today. It was not a major improvement. Streaming was just beginning then. This is an existential threat to our existence. And the way streaming and all the wonderful shows people love are produced. And if we can't reach an agreement with these people, you're going to be watching nothing but game shows and reality shows and, dreck, essentially, if you will. It's not going to be artful television. It's going to be whatever they have to shove on.
Well, thank you so much for explaining that. And the interesting thing is that, I had no idea, but the specter of AI is also creeping into the mix. And that's kind of, I don't know. I don't know if that's the it's, is it inevitable? Do you think? I mean, I think of the metaphor. I'm playing devil's advocate. Sure. When you say begins with the page, well, there is no page anymore. I mean, basically it begins with the screen, I guess. So, when you're saying a story begins with the page, it begins with the screen because we're not writing with.
No, it begins with a human being. Well, of course the screen is the page. I use Final Draft, the best screenwriting software there is. You could do Microsoft Word, but it begins with a human being typing into that page and having an idea and not just having some robot produce an idea. It's like when you call up a company and you hear, and you can't get to a human, you keep going, "I'd like to talk to a representative, please, representative." And they keep talking back to you, or the robot can't get through to a human being. Imagine if that's what your television viewing is going to be in the future. There's a robot there, a robot there, a robot there. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get it. Well, thanks, Peter. I appreciate it very much. From peterlance.com, you can go and take a look at all the activities that's happening with the Writers Guild strike. Peter's kind of doing us a great favor in covering it with the Hollywood Reporter as well. Thank you, Peter.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you so much. You're the greatest.